Thanks, Izzy. Now, first, let me say I am really looking forward to Why Jesus. I think it's going to be really exciting. And we've got, there's 20 spots for 20 guests at the central venue. I'm one of those guests because I'll be giving the talks, but there's room for 19 others. So we want that venue to be filled.
It'd be great to see stacks of houses, dinners going on in different houses around where you're hosting watch parties. And I've heard on the grapevine that Gav may even be coming up with
a five-week menu plan for those who are hosting dinner parties. So you don't even need to think about what you're going to feed people. You can just get Gav's recipes and it might have a shopping list, I don't know. But you can now hold Gav that to it because I've announced it publicly. I'm really looking forward to this. I think it's going to be fantastic. So let's keep praying about it, keep inviting people and plan to be involved yourself. The other thing I want to mention is there may be a small amount of overlap between this first talk from the Book of Ecclesiastes and my first talk of the Why Jesus series. So they're not the same, they're different talks, but there might be a small amount of overlap. So you're kind of at a little few points in this, you'll be getting a sneak preview. But let me start with a question. If you knew you had just a few months to live, what would you do? How would you spend those few months, the remaining weeks of your life? Well, John Brandig in 2005 was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Now, pancreatic cancer is one of the worst, most aggressive forms of cancer. And he was told he had only months to live. So he did what many of us might have done in his circumstances. He decided that he would live life to its fullest. He quit his job. He stopped paying off his mortgage. He gave away most of his possessions. He sold his car, clothes he didn't need, everything. Whatever he didn't need, he sold. Gathered together as much money as he could, and he spent all of his life savings on restaurants and hotels and holidays, living it up in the remaining months of his life. Reebok's tagline in the early 1990s was, "Life is short, play hard." And John Brandig lived the final months of his life by that creed. He played hard. A year later, he had almost nothing left but the suit he had saved to be buried in. And he went back to his doctor, and his doctor told him, "We got it wrong. Actually, it's not pancreatic cancer, it was just an inflammation of your pancreas." He had nothing left, so he sued his doctors for his life savings. But it raises the question for us, you know, for all of us, our time is limited. Now, in Branding's case, not quite as limited as he'd been led to believe. But for all of us, life is short, so what is worthwhile doing? That's the question Ecclesiastes tries to answer. Ecclesiastes 2 verse 3, "I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives." You know, life's short, what should we do? What's worthwhile doing? The writer asks a similar question in chapter 1, verse 3. "What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun?" Now, there in that verse, the word labours and the word toil are different forms of the same Hebrew word. So he's asking, what do people gain from all the toil at which they toil? That's actually one of the features of Ecclesiastes, and especially this first chapter, that a lot of repetition. He's hearing these same words again and again. What do people gain from the toil at which they toil? And that's kind of a theme question for the book of Ecclesiastes. You see it repeated elsewhere, 3 verse 9, "What gain has the worker from his toil?" 5 verse 16, "What gain is there for him who toils for the wind?" The teacher, as he calls himself in verse 1, or as he's called in verse 1, he examines life to work out what it's all about. And he approaches this question with a kind of gritty realism. He wants solid answers, not sentimentalism. He imagines life as a business transaction. You only have so much time. You only have so many years. You only have so much labour. What do you do with it? How will you expend your life? What profit will you have from your labour? Now, this teacher is obviously a man. He's called the Son of David in verse 1. And so he does have a somewhat male perspective on life. What does man gain, he asks. But his question is relevant for all people, for men and women, no matter who you are. And what's more, this book, Ecclesiastes, is going to be useful whether or not you're a Christian. Because the scope of his inquiry is just what happens under the sun. It's not an atheistic perspective as such, but it is a limited perspective. He says, let's just take life as we see it. He confines his search to this mortal life. He leaves aside questions of eternity and heaven and hell and faith and the promises of God. And he says, well, what's life like under the sun? So even if you have your doubts about spiritual things, you'll find most of what Ecclesiastes says resonates with your experience of life. One thing Ecclesiastes will do for all of us is spare us from disappointment. He tells us his conclusion right up front. Chapter 1, verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. It's a pretty devastating assessment on life. This is a good book for emos. The teacher's going to sweep away all of our romantic delusions about life and confront us with its grim absurdity. And the good thing about this kind of pessimism is that it saves you from the pain of false expectations. Now, that word meaningless there in verse 2, it's one of the key words in Ecclesiastes. It occurs 38 times in this book, which is more than half of its total uses in the Old Testament. It's the Hebrew word hevel, and literally it just means something like breath or vapour. Something insubstantial, fleeting, ephemeral. So literally, verse 2 there is breath of breaths. Breath of breaths, everything is breath or vapour. Some translations put it this way, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity. Or futility of futilities, everything is futility. There's a Hebrew idiom that's used here where you kind of repeat the same word. Futility of futilities is a way of expressing a superlative. That is, the greatest example of something. So the Holy of Holies in the temple is the most holy place. And the Song of Songs is the most excellent song. Well, here the teacher's talking in extremes. Futility of futilities. This is the most meaningless, the most futile thing. And he says everything is futility. It's a comprehensive verdict. Nothing under the sun is excluded. Now, what drives him to such a devastating conclusion? Well, in chapters 1 and 2, we see he approaches this issue from two different angles. First, kind of the big picture of the world, and this is the first half of chapter 1, a universal perspective, a top-down approach. And secondly, the enlightening experience of one man, an individual's perspective, a bottom-up approach. So first we're going to look at the universal perspective, and he gives us that in the poem of verses 4 to 11. When you step back and look at the big picture of the world, what do you see? Everything is just endless circles. Verse 4, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. The world just keeps going on and on, around and around, but it's all circular. What we see is enormous activity, but no actual forward progress. And what's true of nature, of the sun, of the wind, is also true of humanity. One generation goes, another one comes, but the world stays the same. There's no gain. There's no profit. None of it makes any difference in the end. Verse 7, all streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. And what's true of the sea is true of human experience too. Verse 8, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. The universe is a closed system. It took science 2,000 years or more to catch up with Ecclesiastes and come up with the law of the conservation of energy. Albert Einstein demonstrated that matter and energy are essentially equivalent, and you can turn matter into energy and you can turn energy into matter, but what you can't do is add to the sum total of matter energy in the universe. You can move it around, but you can't add anything to it. There's no gain. There's nothing new. And people are the same. Lots of activity, but no actual achievement. But someone will say, well, you know, look at the last century. Lots of new things. You know, the 20th century saw the invention of computers and the internet and space travel and antibiotics. But none of it's truly new. Nothing's actually gained. They're just different ways of doing the same things. Computers just different ways of doing calculations, writing books, and wasting time. The internet, just different ways of talking to people and selling stuff and exploiting women. Space travel, well, we can travel to the moon, but there's nothing there, just rocks. And meanwhile, the poor of our world still live in slums of cardboard and scrap metal. Antibiotics? Well, yeah, you live a little bit longer. It just means you can look forward to looking at the walls of a nursing home for 20 years rather than 5. Don't kid yourself. There's nothing new under the sun. The only reason we think there's something new is because we keep forgetting what's come before. When you just consider the basic principles of our universe, it's plain to see that life is futile. You can't gain anything. You can't keep anything. You can't take anything with you. Everything just moves around in pointless circles. Well, if that's the universal perspective, what about the individual's perspective? See, sometimes the best way to learn is by listening to someone who's already made the attempt. And in the rest of chapters 1 and in chapter 2, the teacher conducts an experiment to work out what is worth doing. First, he describes his approach, his methodology. Verses 12 and 13. Verse 12, I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. See, here's his quest, here's his experiment. He wants to study, he wants to explore everything there is about life under the heavens to work out what's meaningful. And he's a thorough student. He investigates everything. He saw all the things, verse 14, that are done under the sun. He leaves no path unexplored, no stone unturned. And the tool he wields in this experiment is wisdom. And it's a tool, he tells us, that he has honed to perfection. Verse 16, I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. But the inquiry is doomed to failure from the start, from the outset. Verse 14, I've seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. So he keeps bumping up against reality. Life is a brute fact. It can't be changed. Now, Christians often think that we will find meaning. In fact, lots of people, not just Christians, noble-minded people, often think we'll find meaning by changing the world. But you won't. You can't change the world. No matter how much you try, the world will still be full of envy and greed and selfishness and cruelty and injustice and death. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. And the more you learn, the greater your wisdom, the more you'll come to realise it's all just meaningless. Not convinced yet? Well, as usual, the teacher has told us his conclusions before he's shown us how he got there. So we'll take a look at some of the details of his experiment in chapter 2 in just a moment. But first I want to just take a brief aside to address the question, who is this teacher? And in particular, is the teacher Solomon, King Solomon, the son of David? Well, I don't think it actually matters much who's writing this book, whether it's Solomon or someone else. It's worth noticing that he never explicitly calls himself Solomon. And I haven't found anywhere else in the Bible that it identifies this teacher as Solomon. And nothing much hangs on it. So, you know, there's no text anywhere in the Bible that says the writer of this book is Solomon. There might be some people who are wondering, why do I keep saying the teacher rather than just saying Solomon? Because there's a long tradition associated with this book that it is the words of Solomon. But in fact, I think probably the author isn't Solomon. Now, he definitely wants us to think about King Solomon. He wants to bring King Solomon to mind. There's plenty in these chapters, especially the first two chapters, that only really fit with what we know about Solomon. You know, king over Israel in Jerusalem, over Israel, all of Israel, Israel and Judah, north and south, with unparalleled wisdom, unmatched by any who had come before, who engaged in building projects and had great wealth and many concubines. At the very least, the teacher, if you like, dresses himself up as King Solomon, puts on his clothes for a couple of chapters, takes on his role. But there are also hints that the teacher's not Solomon. There are other things that don't fit quite as easily. So in verse 116, chapter 1, verse 16, it presumes there's been a whole line of kings in Jerusalem before him, which isn't actually true of Solomon. In Solomon's case, there'd only been one, his father, David. And later chapters speak about kings and about injustice from the perspective of a common man, not from the perspective of a powerful ruler who could do something about it. So on balance, I think the author of this book and the teacher here is not Solomon, but he is deliberately using Solomon in chapters 1 and 2 as a supreme example of the search for meaning. Having said that, I wouldn't go to the stake on it. If it turns out I'm wrong, I won't be too surprised, and I don't think anything much hangs on it. So that out of the way, let's get to the details of this search for meaning. How did the teacher conduct it? What things did he explore? Well, let's look at the start of chapter 2 together from verses 1 to 11. And I'm going to read out this whole section, verses 1 to 11. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Now, his basic motto was, if it feels good, do it. He set out to test life by the criterion of pleasure. He threw himself into this experiment, abandoned himself to his desires, denied himself nothing. There's a key repetition in these verses that some translations unfortunately obscure because it becomes a bit cumbersome in English. But eight times in five verses, we're told that everything he did for himself. Verse 4, I built houses for myself, planted vineyards for myself. Verse 5, made gardens and parks for myself. Verse 6, made reservoirs for myself. Verse 7, had slaves for myself. Verse 7, multiplied flocks for myself. Verse 8, amassed treasures for myself. And acquired singers for myself. All his energy and wisdom and resources were directed toward that end, his own pleasure. Now imagine having the resources and the power and the ability to take whatever you want. Well, King Solomon did. What would you get if you could have anything you wanted? I imagine most of us, if given the opportunity, would have a similar list of exploits. Full of pleasures, both crass and sophisticated. The pleasures of youth and the pleasures of old age. You know, so on the one hand, there are all the things here that UON students get up to on Autonomy Day. I don't know if that's even going to happen this year with COVID lockdown. Hopefully not. But all the kinds of things. Wine and folly and drunkenness and madness and verse 8, musicians and the delights of the heart of man. A harem is mentioned there in verse 8. A harem is a private collection of concubines, mistresses devoted to your sexual gratification. I said earlier there's a male perspective in these chapters, but we certainly see it come to the fore here. But that was the case with King Solomon. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. The phrase translated harem here in this verse occurs only here in the Bible, and it's a literal translation would be a bit cruder than that. Something like, the delights of the heart of man, breasts and even more breasts. Now, like a man counting his sexual conquests, that's how this reads. The teacher indulged himself in all the pleasures of stimulating the body with alcohol and parties and sex. On the other hand, he also gave himself to more refined pleasures. He worked at impressive building projects. He surrounded himself with beautiful gardens and servants and musicians and had wealth and power at his disposal. All the comforts that his money and his toil could buy. He tried it all. Today, pleasure seekers in their 20s might look down on pleasure seekers in their 60s as being past it and not really able to enjoy life anymore, too old for drinking feasts. And pleasure seekers in their 60s might look down on the crude delights of those in their 20s. But in his experiment, the teacher embraced everything. Now, you might think it's all over the top, that it's too extreme, it's too self-indulgent, but that's exactly the point. You know, I imagine very, very few people will have sufficient opportunity or be sufficiently bold to go more than partway down this path. Well, the teacher's experiment took him the whole journey. And our temptation, as our opportunity and our boldness only allows us to go partway down the path of pleasure seeking, so our temptation will always be to think the next few steps will give me what I'm seeking. If I just go a little bit further, or if I could go a little bit further. Maybe if I can get just a bit more pleasure, then my life will be worth something. Then I've gained something. But it's a lie. You know, sure, you might find some enjoyment in the process. Verse 10, the teacher says, my heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labour. Now, there was some enjoyment in the process, but nothing ultimately was gained. There was no profit, nothing lasting or satisfying or meaningful. Verse 11 again, yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. There was a movement in the first decade of this millennium, this century, the new atheism, led by the likes of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris. And it was and it's still around a little bit, but a resurgent and aggressive form of atheism. And, you know, they churned out books justifying atheism and explaining why we should all be atheists. One of those books was by a French philosopher, you might say, called Michel Onfray. And he emphasised in his book, although you see it there as a theme in all of their books, just this sense of liberation. See, if we're freed from the constraints of religion, then we can engage in the unbridled pursuit of personal pleasure. See, that's the attraction of atheism for many. Many people will embrace atheism because they are hedonists. They want to pursue pleasure, and atheism gives them a philosophical justification to do it. I don't think it's intellectual arguments that make atheism attractive. It's a desire for that kind of lifestyle. And most of those writings of the new atheism, they kind of straw-man Christianity. They don't seriously engage seriously engage with Christian faith and beliefs. But it's a license, just like the license that Solomon had to do whatever he wanted. There's something in every one of us that craves after such pleasures. So, friends, let's learn from the book of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing's changed since the Bible was written. There's nothing that means the pursuit of pleasure will be satisfying today when it was empty back then. The world's still the same. You know, countless others have discovered this and continue to discover it. Take Mel Gibson. You know, the actor, Australian actor, he came to fame initially through the Mad Max series of movies, and then he was the star of the Lethal Weapon series of movies as well. Braveheart, that's the picture you're looking at there. Braveheart, he not only acted in, but he directed it. And he won Academy Awards for Best Director and Best Actor for that film. Now, he was at the absolute top of the game in terms of acting and cinema. And here's what he had to say as he assessed his own life. Let's face it. I've been to the pinnacle of what secular utopia has to offer. It's just this kind of everything. I've got money, fame, this, that, and the other. It didn't matter. There wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. It's not good enough. It leaves you empty. The more you eat, the emptier you get. Now, none of this means that God is anti-fun or anti-pleasure. We'll see some more of that later in this chapter. But there's no meaning to be found in the pursuit of pleasure. Pinning your hopes on that as a sure path is a sure path to emptiness and despair. The more you eat, the emptier you get. Learn from Ecclesiastes and save yourself from this futile pursuit. Well, I'm going to get to some conclusions in a moment. But before we do, the teacher briefly deals with three other attempts to find meaning and gain something out of life. When the pursuit of pleasure proves to be nothing but chasing the wind, the teacher shifts the goalpost and he considers some alternatives. So first, wisdom and reputation. You know, isn't there some kind of gain in wisdom itself? He says, verse 12, I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom. What about reputation? The reputation gained from wisdom and success. Well, the teacher concedes there is some limited benefit and gain in wisdom. Verse 13, I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their heads, while the fool walks in the darkness. So at least the wise person understands the world. At least if you're wise, you can see where you're going. But that's a double-edged sword, because look where it is that you're going. Verse 14, but I came to realise that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. They're both going to die. The wise person realises it, but the realisation doesn't really help them. And as for reputation, well, it's meaningless too. You might think you can somehow live on after your death because people will remember your great achievements, but Ecclesiastes 2, verse 16, for the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So wise and fool, both alike, die and are quickly forgotten. No matter how wise you've been and how much you've accomplished, it's all going to go. No one will remember. How many of us sitting here, how many of us can even remember the names of our great-grandparents? Could you name them all? All your great-grandparents? So quickly gone and forgotten. When you look at life under the sun, death always has the last say. Nothing is gained. And this final thought drove the teacher to even deeper pits of pessimism. Verse 17, so I hated life because the work that's done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it's meaningless, a chasing after the wind. But someone else will say, well, I may not gain anything for myself, but I will gain something for my children. You know, I can leave it to them as an inheritance. An attempt to try and force the futile activity of gathering to have some lasting significance. But that's futile too. Verse 19, for who knows whether the person who gets your stuff will be a wise man or a fool? And verse 21, why should he even get it when he hasn't worked for it? Nothing's gained. Even if you have the wisest and most diligent of children and leave an entire kingdom to them, they too will die before too long. Just like the sun and the wind and the rain, all the stuff in the world just keeps going round and round in endless, meaningless circles. But what about job satisfaction? Maybe there's something to be gained by throwing myself into challenging and rewarding work. Well, it's true, we can find some limited enjoyment in our labour, as we've already seen in verse 10. But pursuing work as a source of meaning is just as futile as pursuing pleasure. Like hedonism, careerism just leads to grief and emptiness. Chapter 2, verse 22 and 23. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labour under the sun? All their days their work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. Where does all this searching leave us? We've seen that life under the sun is meaningless. It's futile. It's vanity. It's vapour. This closed system, endless circles, nothing new, nothing to be gained. The pursuit of pleasure is meaningless. Even at its most indulgent, nothing is gained. So what do we do with life? How should we live? Well, this book has two things to say by way of conclusion. First, give up chasing the wind. It's futile. It won't get you anywhere, and there's no need for it. You know, the whole attitude to life that views it as some kind of economic transaction, that mentality is deeply flawed. Life isn't something we spend in order to gain some profit. When you consider life under the sun, there is nothing to be gained but life itself. Sure, everything's meaningless. So the best thing you have under the sun is to enjoy the meaninglessness. Yes, you have to work. Yes, you have to eat. You have to live. But stop seeing these things as an investment that will somehow net you, give you a net gain out of life. No one makes a net gain in life. The world just doesn't work that way. So give up the chase and enjoy life's trivia. That's the first point by way of conclusion, enjoyable trivia. That's the conclusion the teacher comes to in verse 24. Look at verse 24. Here's his conclusion. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Now, in these verses, suddenly God becomes much more prominent than he has been in the rest of the chapter. Because the teacher concludes that we need to change our attitude towards the enjoyable trivia of life. These things are gifts, not gain. They're not tokens we hoard up in the hope that we've somehow gained something by doing that. They're gifts God gives us as we get on in the day-to-day of ordinary existence. Have you noticed that often you'll have the most enjoyable and memorable experiences when you're not even looking for them? They come as a side benefit an unexpected gift from God as you go about your daily life. See, God isn't against pleasure. He isn't opposed to enjoyment. But if you try to live in this world as if pleasure is something you can pursue as an ultimate source of meaning, well, you're blind to reality. Stop chasing the wind. Recognize that all your striving for gain under the sun is futile. But do receive and enjoy the good gifts that God has given you with thanksgiving. Well, there's the first conclusion, enjoyable trivia. The second conclusion is that futility in itself, this futility, can be a blessing. What's the blessing of futility? Well, once you realize, we realize that everything under the sun is meaningless, where then will you think you'll find the answer? You know, where will you look for an answer? If you look under the sun, you're not going to find it. The book of Ecclesiastes, you see, it's like a broom that sweeps away our pretensions and sweeps away our idols and our self-deceptions and our false hopes. See, ultimately, it doesn't leave us looking under the sun. The book of Ecclesiastes is heading to its grand conclusion in chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. And this is the final conclusion of the book. Spoiler alert. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. There is not gain or profit under the sun. The one thing you'll take with you out of this life is God's judgment on how you live. Not other stuff you've accumulated along the way, but the judgment of God. You see, in the end, there is only one thing you can gain and one thing you can lose, and that is yourself. Jesus said, whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet lose or forfeit their very self? To the Christian, let this book work on your life. Let it push us back to finding the centre of our relationship, a centre of our life in our relationship with Christ. You know, there are lots of other things that could compete for the centre, but none of them is worthy. You will not find meaning under the sun, but you will find meaning in the sun. So look to him. Will you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we do ask that you would work on our attitudes and our mindset so that we might approach life in this world with wisdom. Save us from the delusions and pretensions that might deceive us and so direct us down false paths. Save us, Lord, from giving in to the temptation to seek meaning in the pursuit of pleasure or possessions or career or reputation. Help us to recognize this temporary, fragile, fleeting life for what it is. Please give us that humility. Father, we thank you that life is actually a gift from your hand. And all the things that we might enjoy, the satisfaction we might find in work, the food we eat, the friendships we have, all the things we might enjoy, they come from you and they are your gifts. And so we thank you for that. And we pray that you'd help us to receive these things with thanksgiving and always remember they come from you. And Lord, as we realise that we will, like all people, die and face judgment, we pray that you would help us to fix our eyes on Jesus, in whom we can find true meaning and who is the one who prepares us for the judgment day. And we ask it in his name. Amen.